In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, Dr. John Marciano continues his public seminar series with Empire as a Way of Life, a monthly lecture and discussion presented until June of 2007. Dr. Marciano says about Empire as a Way of Life, "A fundamental purpose of our meetings is to understand the systemic nature of the U.S. Empire and the economic and military imperialism that is its lifeblood." The historian William Appleman Williams argues that empire became a way of life in the U.S., a combination of patterns of thought and action that, as it becomes habitual and institutionalized, defines the thrust and character of a culture and society. This way of life has convinced many U.S. Americans they have a right or manifest destiny to impose their political and economic policies upon others. The lectures are given at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Dr. John Marciano is Professor Emeritus, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com.
So, to begin, Michael Parenti asserts that imperialism has been the most powerful force in world history for the past 500 years. The first victims of Western European imperialism, he argues, were other Europeans, for example, the Irish and Eastern Europeans, whom we now call Slavs. Parenti tells us that so frequently and prolonged was the enslavement of Eastern Europeans that Slav became synonymous with servitude. Over the past 500 years, however, European and U.S. imperialism have primarily exploited the Third World, a source of raw material and slaves, and a market for manufactured goods. This market now includes capital in the form of machinery, technology, investments, and loans. The new imperialism differs from earlier empires in the way it systematically accumulates capital through the organized exploitation of labor and the penetration of overseas markets. The key to modern imperialism is capitalist expansion. Parenti challenges the prevailing view of imperialism and third world poverty, often called underdevelopment, arguing that it is often looked at as an original historic condition. This is not the case, he argues, as the third world has long produced great treasures and other natural resources. The truth is that the third world is actually rich. Only its people are poor, and it is because of the pillage they have endured. This analysis is similar to others we have cited in this course and discussed, Samir Amin, Eduardo Galeano, and Felix Green, among others. The rape of the Third World has been justified by self-serving imperialist theories. For example, people in tropical lands are slothful and do not work as hard as those in the temperate zone. This is not true, Parenti argues, as people of warm climates built magnificent civilizations well before Europe emerged from the Dark Ages. And today they often work long, hard hours for meager sums. He challenges Eurocentric theories by citing Europe's social ills during the height of its colonial domination, pointing out that Europe was ahead in such things as social inequality and poverty, mistreatment of women and children, and frequency of famine, slavery, prostitution, piracy, religious massacre, and inquisitional torture. Other than those things, it was a peachy keen place to live in. The ultimate basis of European domination, according to Parenti, has really rested on its advantage in navigation and armaments. Muskets and cannons, Gatling guns and gunboats, and today missiles, helicopter gunships, and fighter bombers have been the deciding factor when West meets East and North meets South. His critique of underdevelopment asks us to see it as a result of social relations that have been forcefully imposed on countries. With the advent of Western colonizers, the people of the Third World were actually set back in their development. British imperialism in India provides an instructive example. Parenti points to a truth hidden by our schooling and mass media indoctrination. The Third World is not underdeveloped, but overexploited. Imperialism has created maldevelopment because wealth is transferred from Third World peoples to U.S. economic elites by direct plunder, the expropriation of natural resources, and other forms of exploitation. Parenti details the third world imperialism that has resulted in oppression. Nations have concentrated on exporting a few raw materials or labor-intensive commodities, and poor nations find themselves in acute competition with other impoverished nations. Attempts by third world countries to overcome their vulnerability by forming trade cartels are usually unsuccessful. This imperialist inequality has also been deepened because in many poor countries, over half the manufacturing assets are owned or controlled by foreign companies. Compounding this inequality is that large portions of the earnings of indebted nations go to servicing their debt. U.S. and European imperialism have also, he argues, been backed by unspeakable repression and state terror. Thus, there have been few, if any, peaceable colonizations. I would maintain there has never been a single peaceable colonial venture anywhere in the world. I'm going a little further than Parenti is. Imperialism, therefore, he argues, is not a natural historical phenomenon because it must rely repeatedly upon armed coercion and repression. Empires do not emerge in a fit of absent-mindedness, as was once said of the British Empire. They are built upon the sword, the whip, and the gun. This truth has almost never been examined in our schools and mass media. Therefore, most citizens here don't have a clue about what the U.S. has actually done to the third world, to those, of course, that we just want to help. Remember, as we've discussed in our course, the U.S. always goes abroad to do good throughout the world. This terror is not some arbitrary or irrational process, but is used to further a larger process of extermination and repression in defense of class interests. It is an eminently rational undertaking to safeguard private overseas interests. It is not mindless or stupid, but quite reasonable, given the fundamental nature of the U.S. capitalist system. Parenti bluntly answers a question that has troubled some U.S. citizens for generations. Why has a professedly peace-loving democratic nation found it necessary to use so much violence and repression against so many people in so many places, and of course over so much time? He argues it's because the ultimate goal of U.S. policy is a quest to make the world safe for the Fortune 500 and its global system of capital accumulation. Those who move towards some kind of economic independence or any sort of populist redistributive politics will face U.S. intervention or invasion. I would argue the evidence for this assertion is overwhelming. In order to get citizens to support such imperialist aggression, U.S. ruling elites must convince the rest of us that we share a common interest with the giant multinationals. But on almost every issue, Parenti claims, the people are not in the same boat with the big companies. I would say every issue, not on almost every issue. Despite this fact, many here have been convinced that there is a common interest in what is one of the greatest triumphs of class-based propaganda in history. Parenti disagrees with what he argues is the popular imperialism view of William Appleman, Williams and Empire as a Way of Life, which is one of the books we've examined, asserting that historically, ordinary Americans usually have opposed intervention or given only lukewarm support. Parenti believes the American people are not the prime motivating force of the war policy. They do not sweep their leaders into war on a tide of popular hysteria. It is the other way around. Their leaders take them for a ride and bring out the worst in them. Although I question this interpretation of Williams, this is an important point. Against their objective interests, brainwashed citizens end up supporting imperialism as a result of propaganda organized and disseminated by the CIA, mass media, U.S. government-funded agencies, and the AFL-CIO. In his discussion of Empire and Democracy, Parenti sounds a great deal like Chalmers Johnson. Strong empire must bring about a weak democracy. Actually, in his latest book, Nemesis, which I just finished, and which I think is the best of Johnson's trilogy by far, Johnson argues empire is destroying democracy. And linked to this destruction is the economic ruin and bankruptcy facing the country from its imperialism abroad. According to Parenti, between 1948 and 1994, the federal government spent almost $11 trillion on the military. That is more than the cumulative monetary value of all human-made wealth in the United States. I mean, if that figure dazzles you, the figure is actually much greater, right? His figures go up to 1994. According to the Center for Defense Information, which is a great group in Washington, often former military people, total military spending from 1946 through 2008, this last year is an estimate, is some $21.6 trillion. The CDI figure covers just official Pentagon spending. It does not include the black box funds for the CIA, our friends at the NSA. They need a lot of equipment to listen to us. Interest on the debt related to past wars, funds for veterans' benefits, all of which would add a few more trillions to the total. I did some calculations. The 21.6 trillion figure comes to $72,000 per capita at the present 300 million people in the United States. That's $2.5 trillion for the state of California, $288 billion just for Los Angeles, and $6.2 billion for little old Santa Monica. Now, you imagine what this city could do with $6.2 billion. Parenti is right, therefore, to ascribe most of our domestic woes to military spending. As he states, the cost of building one aircraft carrier could feed several million of the poorest, hungriest children in America for 10 years. The huge amounts spent on the military mean that Americans must endure the neglect of environmental needs, decay of our cities, and deterioration of our transportation, education, and healthcare systems. Another aspect of empire, and this is also a theme in Chalmers Johnson's latest book, is that it concentrates power in the hands of the few and robs the populace of effective self-rule. The empirical historical data to prove this assertion are overwhelming, especially when it comes to the growth of the imperial presidency since the end of World War II. The U.S. imperialist state has been involved in hundreds of overt and covert acts of aggression around the world in the last 60 years, since the end of World War II. Not one has been declared by Congress as mandated by the Constitution. There has not been a declaration of war since December 8, 1941. Resolutions don't count. Parenti's conclusion in this first section of his book may depress readers. He argues U.S. imperialism has been remarkably successful in undermining popular revolutions and buttressing conservative capitalist regimes in every region of the world. Thus, U.S. imperialism is not stupid and mistake-prone, but actually remarkably successful and brutal in the service of elite economic interests. An analysis of the historical record reveals that the U.S. ruling class has never consciously pursued a policy that put lofty ideals and common people's interests ahead of greed and power. Not once, not ever. A number of scholars have provided supporting evidence for Parenti's assertions on imperialism. In his work, Imperial Delusions, the political theorist Karl Boggs argues that the U.S. has evolved into something of an outlaw rogue state, the kind of fearsome entity conjured up by its own incessant propaganda. This rogue state status, however, has been obscured by Orwellian language, as officials and media pundits apply the term defense to the massive and clearly strategic U.S. global presence. We continually read about the Defense Department, the defense budget, rather than the War Department, which was the accurate name that was changed by the 1947 National Security Act. I'd actually like to go back. I'm a conservative on that issue. Boggs claims that U.S. actions throughout the world have nothing to do with defense and everything to do with terror. Since the U.S. has a long history of warfare against foreign countries, it would be impossible to arrive at a definition of terrorism that excludes its behavior. What little critical understanding of the U.S. system of military terror we have, in his view, owes a great deal to the work on the Pentagon system by the sociologist C. Wright Mills. especially in his classic book, The Power Elite, which came out in 1956. It's really a must-read if you want to understand Pentagon militarism. This book anticipated the dangers of U.S. militarism as it stood virtually alone in its uncompromising critique of the U.S. war economy that enabled citizens to gain a real understanding of how U.S. foreign policy is shaped. What Mills saw in the 1950s was a military-industrial complex that few others were able to see, then or later. Many of us recall Eisenhower's statement in his farewell address about the dangers of the military-industrial complex. But few are aware of C. Wright Mills' far more powerful critique of the Pentagon. It was Mills who first foresaw how the war economy, the Pentagon bureaucracy, and an aggressive foreign policy converged within the same matrix of development and logic. Since World War II, according to Boggs, the United States military has provided an international shield for Western corporations and financial institutions, more global than ever. Despite the propaganda about free enterprise, it's been military Keynesianism that has furnished the major stimulus for dominant economic growth on a foundation of scientific and technical innovations wedded to enormous corporate profits. As Noam Chomsky observes, it is difficult to imagine a system better designed for the benefit of the privileged few than the military system. A fundamental fact of U.S. history, according to Boggs, that the most established, most powerful liberal democracy in the world also has the longest and most brutal record of militarism among all nations, has been hidden by public and intellectual failure to confront the actualities of U.S. military power and the empire it supports. Despite myths to the contrary, the actual history is one of conquest and domination. We go back to Zinn, first chapter with Columbus. Genocidal wars against Indian tribes, the theft of land from Mexico and Spain, and the invasion of Russia after World War I, followed by a succession of bloody military interventions in Korea, Central America, the Caribbean, Persian Gulf, the Balkans, not to mention countless proxy wars, covert acts, and other interventions waged in scores of nations. One can only avoid this factual history by psychological denial and/or outright lying, produced by a compliant educational system and mass media that disarm the public from any substantive understanding and critique of this reality. Boggs asserts that U.S. nationalism has always been ethnocentric, messianic, and arrogant, tied as it has been to an ethos of expansion and conquest. Beneath the high-sounding ideals has been the mundane actuality of a ruthless, manipulative system that, when practiced by other nations, has been scornfully attacked. The dark side of U.S. foreign and military policy, he argues, is not a function of mistakes and miscalculations, but has been integral to the development process itself. The combination of the ethos of conquest, domination, and violence has allowed the U.S. to evolve into an outlaw country, the rogue state of all rogue states, intent on transforming the process of globalization into the building blocks of empire and military domination. Some harsh and tough assertion by Boggs. I would argue they are all true. Iqbal Ahmad, the late Iqbal Ahmad, was one of the world's foremost scholars on imperialism. In a series of essays, he laid out a brilliant critique of U.S. terror in the Third World. In one of them, The Lessons of Vietnam, he wrote about the incredible perceptible gap between our, and here he was speaking about the Third World and his own native land of Pakistan, our need for social transformation and America's insistence on stability, between our impatience for change and America's obsession with order, our move toward revolution and America's belief in the plausibility of achieving reforms under the robber barons of the world, our longing for absolute national sovereignty and America's preference for pliable allies, and our desire to see our national soil free of foreign occupation and America's need for military bases. These truths were impossible for most citizens to see at the time. This article was from 1965. In his notes on American intervention in the Third World, Ahmad states that at one point America symbolized possibility and promises because Americans had declared their commitment to the right of self-determination, had asserted as inalienable the people's right to revolution and charged them with the duty to exercise that right. A belief in anti-imperialist America was part of the mythology he learned growing up in Pakistan. But this idealist picture of U.S. policies was eventually shattered, however, when he and others began to examine the realities of American foreign policy that stood in sharp contrast to the myths we had nourished. The actions of the U.S. government and major corporations that flagrantly betrayed principles embodied in the Declaration of Independence and were anti-nationalist, opposed to revolutions, supportive of dictatorships and fascists, and violently interventionist. People in Pakistan and elsewhere finally woke up when they realized that America was a status quo-seeking interventionist monolith, and it was the war in Vietnam that laid to rest the Third World's myths and illusions. Ahmad pays his respects to those American historians and economists, for example, William Appleman Williams, Paul Barron, Harry Magdoff, and Gabriel Kolko, who helped him and others find the roots of American foreign policy in monopoly capitalism and identify it as a policy in the service of corporations rather than of the public at large. U.S. imperialism, as these and other writers have argued, is in the very bloodstream of the capitalist system. It is inherent to its very nature, not some accidental byproduct. Ahmad claims that U.S. imperialism feeds on what Edward Burns has described as America's extraordinary conception of mission. It is a product, at least in part, of a deep and popularly held belief in the uniqueness of America and its perfection as a political model. He goes on to say, this is Ahmad, that since 1945, no president, secretary of state, or secretary of defense has failed to reproduce and exploit this theme. I would argue that despite the naive belief of many liberals, no future president of this imperialist system will fail to reproduce it as well. In his discussion of the Cold War from the standpoint of its victims, which is a very powerful essay, Ahmad forces us to confront the actual toll of U.S. imperialism from the end of World War II to the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991. He points out that during the so-called Cold War, more than 20 million people died, countless millions were wounded, and more than 100 million people were rendered refugees by what have been variously described as limited and covert wars. Well, they weren't limited for people in the Third World. Virtually all the victims of these wars were people of color in the Third World, the expendable ones on the receiving end of a massive growth in the arms race, resulting in high-tech weapons, except the big one, being tested on human beings in real-life battlefields of Korea, Vietnam, Laos, Lebanon, Afghanistan, and Iraq. He states that some 12 million people died in wars fought in these countries. Drawing on the work of his friend and eminent scholar and activist Edward Said, Ahmad tells us the history of the past four centuries, he's here especially talking about the Third World, is a history of barely recognized Holocausts. For the peoples and nations under assault, those belittled wars were always systemic and often total wars that had profound historical consequences. They were devastating, though most U.S. citizens barely noticed the slaughter in post-World War II, except when the body bags came home from Korea and Vietnam. In his fine work, The New Imperialism, David Harvey analyzes the political economy of the U.S. empire. He first tells us, however, that we know a great deal about U.S. military imperialism abroad. Much is both known and documented from official or quasi-official sources, which is true. There's an absolute mountain of data. And what a despicable and deeply distressing record it is. Liquidation can come, he argues, by a variety of means. The economic power to dominate can be used with equally destructive effect as physical force. Actually, the annual death toll in the Third World from imperialism is far greater than all the wars combined in any single year. You add up starvation, malnutrition, etc. Harvey gives us a brief history lesson in U.S. imperialism since the 1940s, stating that two cardinal principles of international strategic practices had been defined during World War II, and these remain set in stone thereafter. The social order in the U.S. should remain stable. That means no radical redistribution of wealth or power, and no challenge to the elite and or capitalist class control would be tolerated. And there should be a continuous expansion of capitalism to ensure domestic tranquility. The U.S. used its own military power, covert operations, and all manner of economic pressure to ensure the creation or continuation of friendly governments. To this end, it was prepared to support the overthrow of democratically elected governments and to engage directly or indirectly in liquidating those considered opposed to U.S. interests. The key to this imperialist process, according to Harvey, is one fundamental fact. In any conflict between democracy and order and stability built upon property interests, your U.S. ruling class always chooses the latter. It's 100-0. The movements that arose to challenge capitalist imperialism were frequently crushed with ferocious violence by state powers acting in the name of order and stability. Client states supported militarily or in some instances with forces trained by the U.S., as in El Salvador and Nicaragua, took the lead in repressions and liquidations to ruthlessly check activist movements challenging capitalism and imperialism. Militaristic imperialism was absolutely necessary in order to ensure that the benefits of the global system were highly concentrated among a restricted class of multinational CEOs and financiers. This class looked, as always, to the U.S. to protect its asset values and the rights of property and ownership. It paid little heed to place-bound or national loyalties or traditions. It could be multiracial, multi-ethnic, multicultural, and cosmopolitan. In his People's History of the United States, you all remember that from a year or two ago, Howard Zinn discusses the political economy of the U.S. coming out of World War II that helped shape post-war imperialism. The ruling elites needed a permanent war economy to keep the capitalist system going, as they greatly feared a repeat of the Great Depression of the 1930s. They realized that the state, the government, had to subsidize private capital in order to avoid another economic catastrophe. The term permanent war economy was uttered by Charles Wilson, the CEO of General Electric, who warned that after the war, the U.S. had to keep the war economy it had in World War II, with the economic system mainly run by corporate executives and geared to military production and profit. Noam Chomsky also argues that after World War II, most economists and business leaders expected a depression unless there could be massive government aid of the kind that during the war years finally overcame the Great Depression. Of course, business leaders understood that social spending could also avert a market collapse like the 1930s, but it has a downside. You know, it tends to have a democratizing and redistributive effect, whereas military spending is a gift to the corporate elite that keeps on giving. Business leaders were also aware that high-tech industry could not survive in a truly competitive free enterprise economy, and the government must be the savior for their companies. Therefore, virtually the entire new economy after World War II has relied heavily on the military cover to socialize risk, okay? We'll pay for it, but to keep profit private, often after many decades. In essence, the permanent war economy has an economic and purely military function, and one cannot understand the true nature of imperialism apart from it. The context for Zinn's insights on World War II and the Cold War actually goes back to the Soviet Revolution of 1917 and efforts to destroy the USSR and any nation or movement that attempted to challenge capitalist hegemony in the world. Writer and former U.S. State Department official William Bloom argues that the root of the present imperialist struggle lies with the war that began with the Russian Revolution in 1917 and the Red Scare of the 1920s, continued through the McCarthyism of the 1950s to the Reagan Crusade against the evil empire of the 1980s. And now we're in an extension of this war with the war against terrorism. He argues that for more than 70 years until the fall of the USSR, people here were subjected to relentless anti-communist indoctrination, imbibed with their mother's milk and spelled out in their school books. Daily newspapers told them about it. Ministers found sermons in it. Politicians were elected with it. The emerging form of imperialism that took sort of a new shape in the 40s and beyond, according to Bloom, undermined the remarkable international goodwill and credibility enjoyed by the U.S. at the close of World War II that was dissipated country by country, intervention by intervention. The opportunity that was there after World War II to build the war-ravaged world anew, to lay the foundations for peace, prosperity, and justice, collapsed under the awful weight, he argues, of anti-communism. He asks us to ponder a profound dilemma. What did the victims of U.S. anti-communism in the Third World do to bring U.S. intervention, which has brought down upon them the wrath of the world's most powerful nation? He argues it has been self-determination. That's their crime. The desire, born of perceived need and principle, to pursue a path of development independent of U.S. foreign policy objections. Most commonly, this has been manifested in the ambition to free themselves from economic and political subservience to the U.S., their refusal to be a pawn in the Cold War, or the attempt to alter or replace a government which held to neither of these aspirations. This worldwide struggle of the victims of imperialism, the people Franz Fanon called the wretched of the earth, lies at the root of fanatical U.S. efforts to maintain its worldwide empire. In an article for the website ZNet entitled Imperialism 101, The U.S. Addiction to War, Mayhem, and Madness, Stephen Lendman asserts there is no longer a dispute that the U.S. pursues an imperial agenda. Expansion and militarism have always been in our DNA since the early settlers confronted the nation's original inhabitants and then over the next few hundred years slaughtered millions of them to seize their land and resources. Our Declaration of Independence referred to merciless Indian savages and thus gave colonial Americans a moral justification to remove them. Therefore, in our imperial wisdom, we came, we stole, and we conquered for their own good. Lendman jumps ahead in this imperialist lesson to Theodore Roosevelt, one of the nation's most belligerent and racist imperialists. During his era, Roosevelt's aggression extended the U.S. empire to the Philippines, Cuba, Haiti, Guam, the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, and the Canal Zone part of Colombia that, just on its own, broke away to become the new nation of Panama. This venture, of course, was cooked up by Roosevelt and other U.S. officials and was a blatantly illegal and imperialist action. Woodrow Wilson, who I would argue even beat Roosevelt as an imperialist and racist, managed to mystify citizens around the world with his call for the right to self-determination. This deep concern on his part included the military occupation of Nicaragua, Haiti, which lasted for 20 years, and the Dominican Republic, and the invasion of Mexico. This was all to help them have self-determination, evidently. In 1916, Wilson was reelected on a platform promise to keep the United States out of the war in Europe that began in 1914. He was elected on the platform. He kept us out of war. According to Lendman, Wilson had to promise that as the U.S. public overwhelmingly wanted nothing to do with World War I at that point. But he no sooner was reelected than he began making plans to get us into it. Once in the war, he managed to control most public anti-war sentiment with the help of the Espionage and Sedition Acts that allowed no criticism of the government, the armed forces, or the war effort. Whether it was Roosevelt, Wilson, or later presidents, Lendman claims, at the heart of U.S. imperialism has always been the pursuit of wealth and power and a system of governance beholden to capital, now more than ever dominated by giant predatory corporations. Parenti would agree with Lendman's following assertion. It is more true that the flag goes where commerce directs it to secure new markets and a corporate-friendly environment once they've been opened for business. That's how imperialism works and why war is an effective geopolitical way to pursue it. War is just geopolitics by other means, and powerful capital-controlled countries like the U.S. use it freely because it works so well most often. Lendman claims there hasn't been much of a problem in the U.S. convincing citizens to support imperialist policies. So he takes issue with Parenti. As time and again, the public is willing to swallow most any reasons government officials tell them, of course reinforced by the corporate media trumpeting them like gospel, to get them to go along with the schemes they have in mind, no matter how outrageous they are. As with Parenti, therefore, Lendman actually believes U.S. imperialism has been quite successful. The scaremongering scam has been used so often with the same or similar language and that later proved false, you'd think the public by now would have caught on. But you'd be wrong. Up to now, it's worked like a charm every time, proving you can fool most of the people all the time. University of Texas scholar and activist Robert Jensen, whose insights we have examined in this course from his book Citizens of the Empire, also complements Parenti's critique of empire. Jensen believes that Americans need to come to terms with a harsh reality. In the post-World War II world, a primary function of the U.S. military has been to kill mostly non-white people in the Third World to extend and deepen American power. Therefore, he opposes both nationalism and patriotism, arguing it is time to sweep away the notion, patriotism, and acknowledge it as morally, politically, and intellectually bankrupt. His critique of the link between imperialism and patriotism, therefore, is one that forces, especially progressives, to re-examine their fundamental beliefs about the nation and its policies. He, too, asks a simple question that is almost never addressed by our nation's educational institutions and mass media. Why is it that our political culture, the highest expression of the ideals of freedom and democracy, has routinely gone around the world, overthrowing democratically elected governments, supporting brutal dictators, funding and training proxy terrorist armies, and unleashing brutal attacks on civilians when we go to war? Good question. I think Parenti's analysis in Against Empire provides a very cogent and truthful answer to Jensen's anguished question. And I'm sure it's a question any concerned person in this society has asked. Jensen claims that in the U.S., patriots not only can get by without knowing much about the wider world, but are systematically encouraged not to think independently or critically and institutionally, to accept a mythology of the United States as a benevolent, misunderstood, flawed giant as it lumbers around the world trying to do good. It is this fundamental proposition, I argue, that the U.S. government is a force for good in the world that must be analyzed objectively, honestly, confronted, and ripped out by the roots if we are to end the imperialist terror that this government has unleashed on people around the world. Let's take a break. Let's have our usual discussion. I don't know who's first, Jim, Kit.
We sold these books at the Midnight Special for a long time, and I have Parenti's books in the... I always wanted to read him, so I was glad that we got the opportunity to do this. And I thought it was really great, except at the beginning I was not very happy with it. And he pointed out that there's a possibility of capitalism without imperialism, and I don't see that. And from all the things I've ever read, it was a necessity of capitalism to grow, and that even in very minor primitive capitalism, it was always whoever Kuatu, the next one down the line. And I was kind of surprised that he made that statement in there.
I'm actually going to jot some things down because I haven't been in touch with him for a while. I've known Michael for a number of years, and it'd be interesting to have him here because I'm sure we agree on most things, but to have two Sicilian Americans arguing about these issues would be very interesting. But I want to ask him because I was curious about that point too, and thinking of a number of books he's written since this came out, it seems to contradict the general argument. And so I'm going to send them an email that, you know, these are things that were raised in the group, and he'll get back to me, and I'll share it with you. So thank you for raising it.
I'm just puzzled about the kind of explanation that Parenti and lots of other people in the course are giving. Is it supposed to be that imperialism is one theme in American foreign policy, a strong theme, and so on and so forth, but there are other possible desires, thrusts for Americans? I mean, again, there's this question of, keeps coming up in my mind, United Nations, or perhaps other aid programs. Are these always in the service of imperialism or not? I mean, are you going to picture American foreign policy as monolithic, as having only one goal, or does it have many, with the maybe imperialism as at least a very dominant one? I mean, I'm not sure what kind of explanation we're being asked to accept here.
Expand on that a little more. I mean, in terms of what he seems to be arguing?
Well, Parenti, but I'm just repeating myself when I raise the same point about William Appleman Williams. But Parenti, too, because he's covering the period when the United Nations was very much in force and promoted and seemingly with American support. Think of the aid programs. I mean, you might say, well, these are all minor and they're always in the service of imperialism and so on. But is that so clear? And in any case, why should the United States support an organization like the United Nations, which is, after all, has a Security Council, and the United States is only one among five countries that has a veto. So why should we promote that if we're going to be imperialist and the like?
This is something that Kit and I have talked about, and he's raised in the group, in terms of the role of the United Nations. It would seem to me that the Parenti, you know, again, try to think of how he would respond, and then I'll respond, that probably argued that some of the agencies of the United Nations have done some marvelous work since the founding of the organization we're talking now more than 60 years. But I think at the same time he would argue that in terms of U.S. aggression, U.S. imperialism in the world, especially in the third world, not just in the third world, because some of the earliest U.S. moves in the world that involved the Central Intelligence Agency were not, quote-unquote, in the third world. They were against Italy and Greece and France after World War II. They were to disrupt in Italy and France, of course, the possibility that Communist Party would win power. So millions, tens of millions of dollars were pumped into Italy and France, and then hundreds of millions of dollars under the Truman Doctrine to defeat the left in Greece. I think he'd make the argument, and I would make the argument, that in terms of the fundamental thrust, even granting certainly the potential and some of the reality of the UN to temper aggression in the world, that as an institution, as an organization, it has been unable to really block the U.S. assault, imperialist assault, especially in the third world, in Vietnam, against China, Laos, Cambodia, Nicaragua, El Salvador, I mean, just, you know, throw a dart, Southern Africa, Angola, Mozambique, etc. And in saying that, not necessarily being critical of the UN, because the U.S., in a sense, was always trying to, in the U.S., the people making the decisions for the government. And here we've got to be clear, because it's not the U.S. as a whole. Chalmers Johnson's new book is especially powerful on describing how the executive branch of government, increasingly since Truman, but starting with Roosevelt, has bypassed Congress totally. So there's no discussion whatsoever, no public discussion whatsoever of involving the special forces or the CIA in this country or that country. So, and people in the UN, of course, didn't know this. So you can't really fault this institution when the U.S. is clearly a smaller group within the U.S., even bypassing the elected officials of the people, And, of course, never worrying about the judiciary, because the judiciary has never confronted the ability of the president since World War II on the issue of war. I mean, they absolutely refused to deal with these issues during Vietnam or any other war. So I think you're right, but at the same time, it has been unable to block this, what Iqbal Ahmad would call this violent, it wasn't a Cold War, it was a hot war against the Third World. No institution within the U.S. or no world institution has been able to block that. The only thing that has blocked the U.S., of course, in Korea and Vietnam and elsewhere, has been the resistance of the people who were victimized by the U.S., aided during the Vietnam War by a very strong anti-war movement, and aided by, even though there wasn't that kind of anti-war movement during the Korean War, after the initial, certain initial successes by the U.S. when they marched under MacArthur to the Yalu River, public opinion turns dramatically against the Korean War. A lot of Korean War was an extremely unpopular war in the U.S. by polling data. There weren't massive demonstrations in the U.S. as in 1952, as we found in, 1968. So it's a mixed bag.
Yeah, hi, I'm Jay from Santa Monica. I think your last point was a segue into the points I would make, because reading about Parenti's analysis, which is fine as far as it goes, basically is what I consider a looking back analysis, what it has been, what we have undergone, and has not particularly addressed the future or what I'll call a macro analysis of empires in general, because it's been specific basically to the United States. My thinking going through this is that all empires have a natural evolutionary dynamic. Basically, they grow until they're too large to control their borders or to defend themselves. The Roman, the Ottoman, the Catholic, the Islamic, the Chinese, the Aztec, and the Soviet empires all have that in common. And I think it is a natural dynamic of which the same will happen to the United States, which is happening now. Secondly, there's massive new forces happening now that didn't happen 50 years ago. Tom Friedman's work on globalization, not that I agree with it, but he does point out dramatically how this function of the virtual economies that business operates on has eliminated the need for control of physical geography and control of the physical government, such as in Vietnam, where they're making Van Heusen shirts, China, oh, I don't have to say how much we're importing from them, that these new forces, primarily driven by communication, have a fundamental aspect on the prior analysis and methodologies we used on American search for markets and control for markets. And lastly, within the United States, I don't think he deals with this question except explaining it without talking about what the resolution is. The function that we have a democratic elections as a, in the country as really as a function of domestic policy, and rarely has foreign policy been the key component in elections, putting the Kennedy-Nixon missile gap aside for the moment, which is a good example where it was. But basically, we have a dictatorship in foreign policy in this country, which calls for really a new structure, a new process to control the foreign policy power of the president. Until we have that, we're going to just keep on going until the natural evolution of the empire just collapses on its borders.
Jay, would you talk a little more about, because this is a really powerful point. So we have a formal democratic structure, even granting how much money is involved, but let's say a formal democratic structure politically in terms of elections, in contradiction with a dictatorship in foreign policy.
Precisely, no. Domestic policy drives the so-called democratic election process in the country. There's gay marriage, abortion, medical coverage. Think of all the issues in the last previous presidential elections. Going back to Nixon Kennedy, which was the exception. Nixon Kennedy was the missile gap, or the Soviet this, the Soviet that. But even prior to that, under Eisenhower, was get out of the war. Part of it was to get out of the Korean War, but primarily all the president of Roosevelt was, the economy. All his elections were basically built on the economy. So I see where foreign policy is not the determinant in the democratic process of elections, and thus foreign policy winds up really being a dictatorship in the way it's handled within the United States.
And again, for the some of you will end up reading Chalmers Johnson's newest book, Nemesis, but he also discussed this in Sorrows of Empire. His argument that increasingly that dictatorship, that power to engage, involve the U.S. in wars, covert, overt, is undermining the democratic institutions of society so that there's no public debate. Should we go to war? We'll have a full debate.
And there's two key important points. First of all, today in the year 2007, we are dramatically different in the way that the secret government has been operating. Up to now through the CIA and all these years, it's been the government has a secret agenda, a secret organization in effect through the Central Intelligence Agency, but it's been a government operated. Today we have over, almost 150,000 private contractors in Baghdad that is now pulling in industry, that Blackwater, this massive expansion of Blackwater by the privatization of the secret foreign policy is now taking on an enormous new step. And it's going to basically double the effort, but it's going to be doubling it by channeling, on the one hand, through private entities as well as the public government military entities. There'll be private armies.
Just a final thought bouncing off of what Jay's raised, that I think Parenti, Grandin, Roxanne, Dunbar, Ortiz, John Bellamy Foster, any of the readings, I would argue Williams would make this argument too, that whether it's the secret government, whether it's the CIA, whether it's overt involvement by the U.S. government, whether it's private armies, that the form of imperialism can change, but that the basic goals remain the same. So if it's a set of private contractors in Iraq doing what, let's say, the CIA might be doing, their argument would be that the real goals don't change, the form of how it's done. But that is a new phenomenon. And incredibly, I mean, that's simply, it's not that there weren't any private contractors in Vietnam during the war, but this has expanded dramatically so that within, for example, the armed forces, I mean, people in the armed forces are not doing KP, are not feeding people, are not driving trucks. This has all been subcontracted out. So if you're looking for a job, you know.
These 70 pages were some of the best 70 pages I've read in a while. I really thought he really nailed so much. And I thought your discussion of it was excellent. And you had me until the last bit. And I may have misinterpreted something that you said at the end. I don't know. But this seems to be a bone of contention before. And that I really like what he said about how war hysteria is engendered from the top down, not from the bottom up, that the masses are swept along in that. And I agree with you that we're not kept well informed of what's going on internationally. But if you implied in the end of what you had to say that people don't know what's going on or don't know what's happening, or I disagree so much with that, as I have before, if maybe not exactly what's going on in a particular country. I think people recognize, at least where I grew up, what the government of the United States is about. I don't think they have a lot of illusions. I think a lot of people don't vote because of that. I think a lot of people don't see the American state as being for them or about them. And I just think we're in the master's house. I don't like to use this illusion, but it's a little bit, you know, the master in the field, slave. I don't like to use that, but we're in the master's house, and occasionally we'll spit in the soup, but it hasn't been shown to the American people, or it has been shown to the American people, what happens exactly if you oppose. There hasn't been a real example of a successful defeat of the system, and it has been shown over and over what happens if you try to go against it. So I just think it's one of those, if you can't beat them, join them, and just hope for the best, and you're busy and just trying to survive and live your life. And I don't think a lot of people are disillusioned, or that's delusional, as the middle class might be, or the upper middle class, or the media might lead us to believe that they are. The people who speak out a lot might be under this illusion, but most people, I think, are not most poor working people. People don't talk about it, but they know about it. So if you are implying otherwise, I disagree once again.
That's okay. Well, that's what makes our evenings fun together. I meant at a much more, a deeper and more systematic understanding of exactly how this system works economically and politically around the world. I mean, clearly, at some level, virtually everyone in the society has some idea that the United States is involved in a war in Iraq, all right? But in terms of having any kind of analysis, and especially working people, because from that segment, increasingly today, as less so in Vietnam, less so in Korea, and of course, dramatically less so in World War II. That's where most of the men and women in the armed forces come from. They're not coming from those who just got their BA degree at Stanford who decide I should enlist in the Marines. Those days are over. But I think that they clearly, because of the mass media, because of our educational system, because every area of society, and I include religion, that helped to shape our understanding of the society, there's, I would argue, that a real good factual knowledge of what the U.S. has done over the last 60 years is not within the purview of most people. And I would also argue that if there wasn't a massive resistance, whatever we may think about the nature of the resistance in Iraq, most Americans would not oppose this war. They simply wouldn't oppose the war, as most Americans did not really oppose the war in Vietnam until the body bags were coming to the small towns and neighborhoods. And that is because, and here I would agree with Parenti, that the elite consistently, secretly as well as publicly, shaped our consciousness to get us prepared war after war to support their ends. They want to take, because I agree with him that I don't think you get this, I mean, you didn't get this, you know, massive demonstrations of working people all over the U.S. getting out in the streets saying, we should invade Iraq, we should invade Iraq. This was organized by Bush and a small group of people, and you've got to convince enough people in the society. And I would make the same argument, because I think the odds are fairly strong that it's going to happen, as tragic as it's going to be, if the U.S. attacks Iran. I think if you poll Americans, people in the United States, I think most people are going to go along with it. I think overwhelmingly everyone in Congress is going to go along with it. And it would be that case until, if it unfolds in a similar way, it doesn't appear as if the U.S. is going to invade with ground forces, because the armed forces are now stretched so thin in Iraq and Afghanistan that the notion of sending ground troops into Iran is just insane. But, I mean, hey, it might happen. So that is, I don't think we've been, because it's not brain chemistry. I think any person in this society with any kind of educational background can read this material and understand it. It's not theoretical physics. I think it's actually quite simple. And you're right, millions of people understand it at some level that, you know, something's not right. And at some level, there are tens of millions of people who understand that. But at the same time, I think he's right that the people running this country have enough control of the media and enough arguments to make, even though that's true. I would argue that's true objectively. When they poll people to say this government stands for people like us or the rich, the polls are dramatically high that support your argument, Laura. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, we have been disabled enough not to learn how to think critically, so that time and time again, the government has been able to pull off things even against the people's will. I mean, you know, to go back to Jay's point, because I agreed and disagreed, Lyndon Johnson ran on a platform of peace in 1964. It was the first election I could vote, all right? Voted for Lyndon Johnson. It's the last mistake that I made about that issue, though I voted and supported McGovern in 1972 because he would have ended the war. As I think if Bobby Kennedy had been alive and he would have been elected president in 1968, the Vietnam War would have ended before 1975. But he clearly had to go before the people who were suspicious and did not want a wider war in Asia, while at the same time they actually were escalating the war, and they managed then to convince the American people to support it, even though most of the people in the country would agree with you and were very, not cynical, skeptical. What are they doing? What are they doing? So taking Parenti and just concluding is, I think the ruling class in this country has been able to get away with murder time and time again, even though there's been lots of opposition. We were talking about Central America in the 1980s, tremendous opposition to what the U.S. was doing in El Salvador and Nicaragua. Yet the U.S. was able to absolutely devastate those two countries.
Do you think the population's wising up now?
Well, my argument is the population wises up not for the right reason, not because we're killing a lot of Iraqis. If we were killing 650,000 Iraqis, but there was almost no American casualties, There would be no anti-war sentiment in this country except for those who are against it on principle. That's what disturbs me very much. And that's in the sense you can pull people along as long as we don't pay for the piper. And if you send enough body bags home, this war would have ended sooner. There's only been 3,500 people killed. Now, that's for those families that have lost people. That's a lot of people. But it doesn't touch what's happening to the Iraqis. It's always about us. It's always about us. So I don't know whether we've wised up. I don't think so. But so we agree and we disagree.
Maybe the empire will fall on its face eventually. I mean, we can hope that much. Or, you know, we keep chipping away at it or putting grains of sand on it. It'll tilt or something. But I guess we don't have any choice but to fight back. Anyway, I have a couple of comments and maybe a question. I wanted to respond to the thing about the UN because I think the UN is a mixed bag and that it's often, the aid is often used as persuasion. It's used as blackmail. We saw that in the many, many times, like the first Gulf War is a good example where they said, well, if you don't vote with us or join the coalition or whatever, we're going to cut your aid off. And so the UN has become sort of a tool where the U.S. can use it in whatever way they want. My question, well, okay, globalization is this big thing that goes in, and I think they use whatever method works. If they can use economic sanctions or globalization or privatize and, you know, do it that way, they will. If they can't, then they use war, or they'll use all three of those methods, you know. And right now they had to use war in the Middle East because they couldn't do it otherwise, I guess. But how are we going to combat the propaganda with Iran? I mean, the propaganda is really working. It's out there. It's persistent. And we know that Iran is, you know, signed on to the non-proliferation treaty, so did the U.S. And the U.S. has broken a lot of those things. I mean, it's going ahead with all kinds of bunker buster nuclear programs and this, that, and the other. And Israel, what about Israel with its weapons? Iran doesn't have enough of these. They have the rights, by the way, under the treaty to have nuclear energy if they want to, which I don't think is a good thing for anybody, but they have the right. And they have some centrifuges, but they don't have very many, and they don't have the ability to make those work for a long time, and they don't have nearly enough to make, you know, nuclear weapons. And so this is the reality, but we don't hear this. This is not the propaganda that we hear. So how can we get out there and educate people about, you know, the real facts rather than the propaganda, which says that they're kidnapping people, but we're not talking about the covert operations that we've been doing over the border, supporting all kinds of guerrilla covert operations across the border.
Before, because you said you had a question, again, to tie it with what Laura raised, what Jay raised, U.S. forces and U.S.-supported forces are now at war inside the sovereign state of Iran. That's a fact, okay? That's a fact. If people don't want to deal with it, you know, quote unquote, we live in a free country. Most people, and to go back to your question, most people do not know that. If you had a factual question, if you ask people, you've got 1,000 people and you poll them, many people wouldn't even know where Iran is, but they would not know what their government is now doing. And for large measure, of course, that's the government's doing its best to make sure that people don't know that. So, I mean, you can't fault people. Well, I can't think critically about this issue. Well, I haven't been given the opportunity. So that's the reality. And that's been the reality for U.S. armed forces overtly and covertly. Just take since 1945. We don't even talk about, you know, Wilson sending troops into Mexico and Nicaragua and Haiti, et cetera, you know, all to give them self-determination. So my argument is, and it may strike you as being cynical, but I don't think of myself as a cynical person. I think of myself as trying to be realistic in terms of what the evidence tells us, is that on moral grounds alone, I mean, that is against international law. It's morally reprehensible. It's illegal. There's been no discussion in the Congress of the United States to affirm that we should declare it's war. We're at war with Iran, okay? And my argument is that the American people, people in the United States of America, will not turn against that war unless the Iranians make the costs too high. the people in this country are not going to oppose an attack on Iran because it's a lousy thing to do. Of course, they would be outraged if the Iranians, I mean, imagine if the Iranians were sending troops into the U.S., they were sending under the kind of troops, they were paying Canadians to slip over the Peace Bridge in Buffalo, where I used to live, or they're coming over in Niagara Falls, and they're bombing some things in Rochester and Syracuse and upstate New York. There have been bombings inside of Iran. There have been kidnappings inside of Iran. So that alone, even as more people come to embrace that, that alone will be filtered into one's worldview. And our worldview, most of us in this country, has been to demonize Iran. So therefore, it's okay for us to do it. And it won't be okay only, what will stop it, is if the Iranians send enough caskets back to the United States. I think about that in terms of my background and in terms of, you know, my brother being in Vietnam and remembering burying his best friend and our family friend, you know, a wonderful young man. And it was those deaths coming back to the U.S. that forced people to really think about that conflict. Now, no one that I know of, that any U.S. service personnel has been killed inside Iran to this point. I haven't heard about that. Deirdre, you had your, or Jack.
Sometimes I think the readings and even the lecture, both the readings and the lecture, sometimes I think comes across with the United States being more monolithic, perhaps, than it is. I think it's a very complex nation in many ways. The whole notion of free speech and people take that seriously and they do talk and demonstrate and whatever. There are many factions. There are many differences of opinion that you run into. There are different parties, not just the two parties, which are different than the same, but third parties, independent parties, more than you want to know about and whatever. And there are a lot of intelligent people in the United States who do read, they're thoughtful. And we have, if you go to any other country, the number of colleges and universities here is amazing. Sometimes I'm so shocked that we can have so many educational institutions and such a dumb population. You know, those people, sociologists who study power structure in the United States, really talk about power structures. There isn't simply a monolithic power. There are economic elites, there are political elites. Even within the economic elites, there are different interests, oil versus real estate, whatever. And then we have the division of powers. Within the government. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, more so, less so, but it's there. It can go into operation at any time. And also, I think we should recognize that there are many decent people in the United States, many decent people. Sometimes our politics and foreign affairs, it seems to me, doesn't reflect the degree that this is so. So I'm trying to bring up the complexity versus monolithic aspect. And I think this causes the people in power to not be able to move with a totally free hand. I think there has to be a lot of cosmetics about what's going on, fuzziness, propaganda, whatever. They don't have the easiest job. I think in the Roman Empire they maybe had it easier. Maybe I think this is part of the reason that maybe we won't collapse in the same way that the Roman Empire did. At any rate, I think people are separated from foreign policy because it's away. It's foreign. It's at a distance. And therefore are victimized by the media, by political propaganda and political rhetoric. And maybe Americans don't always function in regard to foreign policy the way they would if they knew more about it. Maybe they're not quite as evil as John is suggesting. maybe it's a combination of evil and uninformed in combination with each other. And because you're far away from it, fear can be injected. That's unrealistic fear, but nevertheless, realistic in its impact.
All right. I've tried to jot down a few notes to capture some of Jack's major points. I was reading the transcript today of the Democracy Now! Program yesterday with Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky, and they were on today. But Howard Zinn commented, this is to get back to what extent we have knowledge of what's going on in the country, and it's also the connection to the comment Jack made about higher education in the United States. There are 15 million students in colleges and universities in the United States. It's a mass institution. And I think you know as well as I do, any of us who've taught college, is that sometimes we're staggered, one on one hand by the level of real insight of students at any age, and also staggered by a level of ignorance that is created, historical ignorance. Howard Zinn spoke recently to an advanced placement class in a high school in the United States somewhere, he didn't indicate where. There were about 100 students, and he asked the students if they knew anything about My Lai, and not a single hand went up. These are the best and the brightest of American students. And I know I did not teach in an elite institution. I taught in a state college, mostly first-generation college students. And when it came to these issues, and again, they were created, virtually none of my students could think critically about these issues because they had been disarmed critically from examining these issues. Talking about the Vietnam War was like talking about, you know, the Norman invasion of England or something. And all of us were at that point at some time in our lives. So the ability to challenge the dominant elite or the dominant view of this country is still with us despite the fact that we don't have an elite system of higher education. We have a mass system of higher education. Huge numbers of young people who graduate high school or go to college. It's 2-year, 4-year, public, private, etc. As for the separation of powers, I think, and again, I rarely, if ever, want to talk about the future because I'm not sure what might happen, but I feel competent to talk about the past. We do have, despite the fact that formally we do have a separation of powers as established by the Constitution of the United States and as written about extensively by the founding fathers, especially Madison. At the same time, I would argue and respectfully disagree that the evidence is simply overwhelming that Congress has absolutely had virtually no power whatsoever to stop any U.S. president from getting us involved in a war after Roosevelt died. Roosevelt actually went to Congress the day after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and that's the last time a president has done that. And Chalmers Johnson can make this argument better than I can. He's got a whole book to make the argument that increasingly the empire has fewer and fewer people making decisions and then presenting them to Congress as a fait accompli. We are in Iran. We're going into Iraq. Or as Bush number one, Bush senior, moving 500,000 troops into the desert of the Middle East and then going to the Congress of the United States for a resolution. Remember, that was not a declaration of war. The Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, says Congress shall declare war. It doesn't say Congress shall declare a resolution. So my argument is, as a citizen, stepping outside of history, is if we want to make war on Iraq, on Iran, on any country, we have a constitution, and here I'm a conservative, we have a constitution. You go to Congress and you vote to go to war. Hillary, McCain, I don't care who it is. The president goes to Congress and says, listen, these people are going to be a threat. They may end up with nuclear power, nuclear weapons. We have a constitution. I want the authority to go to war. He doesn't have to do it the next day. I mean, he's got it in hand. So the whole issue of separation of powers, I think the argument is that increasingly the executive branch runs the ship. The judiciary and the Congress trail along. And no court in this land is going to declare any war the U.S. gets in as unconstitutional. No court has done this or will do it. There is complexity in the ruling class. There are differences. There's no doubt. There are differences, not just over tactic. I mean, there were people, Brent Scowcroft and others, who were George Bush Sr.'s advisors, who were very, very, very opposed to the U.S. going into war. And it'd be interesting if we could have been a fly in the room on someone's shoulder to hear Scowcroft and Bush Sr. and James Baker talking about George Jr. and what he was planning to do. So there's no doubt that there are differences within the dominant groups in the society. But I think Parenti would argue, I would say William Appelwin Williams would also argue, it appears to be Grandin's thesis, that when it comes to the basic ends of American foreign policy, I would argue it's pretty monolithic, that the U.S., the people who run this country, are clearly not going to take the side of Iran. They clearly could not take the side of the Sandinistas. They could not let the FMLN win in El Salvador. On that issue, it's monolithic. How we deal with these people, there, the complexity is extraordinary. And if you read the documents coming out on the Iraq War, what Jack says about complexity is absolutely on the mark. I mean, almost virulent discussions. Some people almost accusing other people of being traitors and being un-American for suggesting that we shouldn't support the president. And these are people who are eminently in the elite, getting attacked by others. And of course, in hindsight, they were proven right. So,
I guess it's my turn. Just a couple things I wanted to mention. It's interesting to hear that we do have forces in Iran right now. And I would have expected, if that were the case, for the New York Times and so forth to have that news spread across the front page. I haven't seen it yet. And a second point, obvious, that the U.S. has been squandering, is continuing to squander, the decades-long positive image that it's had throughout much of the Third World, Middle East included, of being a beacon of democracy for the world. What's happened? The people I knew from the Middle East in decades ago, in the 60s, looked to this nation with a strong reverence for the example that we had provided for the rest of the world, and we've lost it.
Just one comment on that. I would suggest that we were also bamboozled, because if you actually look at U.S. history, I mean, Ahmad tries to get at this in some of his essays. When we actually look at the history of the U.S. government since 1789, since we became a nation, because I think all of us grew up. We grew up in the U.S. and we defeated fascism in World War II, and many of us, as I did, had, you know, uncles in World War II and Korea, and we stood for certain things, the country, etc. And that's why the Zinn book is often, people's history is an eye-opener for many of us, and certainly was for my students. How could we be a beacon of hope given, first of all, that the U.S. government was at war with hundreds of Indian nations, right? There were wars. There were hundreds of wars from the beginning, from the colonial period. The U.S. invaded Spanish Florida. The U.S. invaded...
It's because we were so generous. We wanted to...
Right. But what I'm saying is even those of us in the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War went in with blinders, that somehow, how could we possibly be doing this to these people? If we had understood our own history, we wouldn't have been shocked, because that's what we did in Mexico. And I worked with people in Boston who were putting together we worked on a Vietnam curriculum, and it forced some people to go back, and they were doing a curriculum on the Philippines War. You talk about almost two clone wars. You talk about wars in the search and destroy missions. You talk about the racism, the absolute butchery. If we had had any idea of what the U.S. had done in the Philippines, we would not have been shocked in Vietnam. We would say, well, there they go again. You know, as Reagan said, ooh, there they go again. Let's go home. Let's go to Izzy's.
You have been listening to Empire as a Way of Life, a lecture and discussion series given by Dr. John Marciano. This group meets monthly until June of 2007 at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. the LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots, social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.